The Tom Woods Show, episode 2285.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be joined today by Wilfred Riley, who is, are you a professor at, gosh, I should have looked this up. What's the matter with me? Is it Western Kentucky?
No, it's Kentucky State, which is a similar institution, although with an HBCU tradition. But yeah, Kentucky State U.
Oh, Kentucky State U. I got a little confused because I actually knew somebody who used to teach at Eastern Kentucky University, and I guess I got them a little bit mixed up in my mind. You are the author, most recently, of a book called Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. And it's quite a provocative work. And I do see, in fact, even sometimes quite explicitly, a reference to Thomas Sowell in it. And it tells a lot of different groups, a lot of things that whether they want to hear them or not, they really do need to hear them. And I mean a lot of groups. It's not just telling, let's say, the progressive left things they need to hear. I think you do a very, very interesting and provocative job of introducing information that I think a lot of people on all sides simply don't know about. So now, as the host of a 30-minute podcast, it's up to me to decide which of the 10 we can remotely try to cover at any length. But Will, I will say this. I think if there's one benefit of being on the Tom Woods Show rather than on Joe Rogan, yes, sure, my audience is not quite as large, but I think with a half-hour podcast, people are more likely to say, I got to go get that book. Whereas 3 hours, they feel like they already read it. So having said that, let's dive right into what is, I think, your longest chapter, as a matter of fact, and maybe because you have the most persuading to do in this chapter, and that's chapter one, and you call it Taboo, Obvious Fact Number One, the police aren't murdering black people. This obviously does run counter to the impression most people are given, whereas you, on the other hand, think of it as being part of what you call the continuing oppression narrative. How are we to evaluate these kinds of claims? We do seem to see on our television screens examples of police brutality and indeed outright police killings. What's the problem here? Are we getting the wrong data? Are we getting selective data? Where are we going wrong in our understanding of this?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the first chapter of the book is called The Police Aren't Murdering or Mass Murdering, I believe, if we do a new edition, black people. And I stand by that statement. It's just obviously factually true. So no one denies that there is some police brutality in the world. And I think, again, we're both intelligent adult men. We don't need to go through all these cliches, like, and of course we object to this, so on down the line. But the narrative that was presented by the Black Lives Matter activist movement over the past couple of years was remarkably consistent, that there was an epidemic of this, of just innocent brothers being killed while they were, the picture was painted, just trying to get out of the car or walking to a basketball game or going to church. And I mean, you see, for example, Chernobyl went on Fox News Primetime Live and said that every day an innocent, presumably totally unarmed, black man is murdered, his words. So that'd be about perhaps 300 totally innocent victims every year. Ben Crump, one of America's most prominent attorneys, went a lot farther. He wrote a book called Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People. If I remember correctly, he put that figure in the thousands. This is all complete nonsense, especially if you're talking about unarmed men. I mean, since at least 2015, the Washington Post has maintained a database known as The Counted. So we know exactly how many people are killed by the police or are killed by the police unprovokedly in a typical year. And in a typical year, about 1,000 people overall are fatally shot by police officers in the United States out of about 60 million police interactions. And this is almost never mentioned, but generally less than 30% of them are black. In 2015, the year I opened Taboo with, there were around 250 fatal shootings of African Americans out of that total of 998. That's very typical. So 70 to 80% of the individuals killed by the police are Caucasian, whites, or Hispanics. That's simply never mentioned. And the large majority of people who are involved in violent clashes with the police are people who are attacking law enforcement officers or committing crimes. So if you break down the data even further, the total number of unarmed, specifically Black men, shot by police in the most recent year on record, which I think right now is 2021, was 7. So I don't want to just keep rambling through a list of statistics, but the claim that there's an epidemic of police murders of innocent people simply is not real. And there's also another statistical point here that gets pretty awkward, but that's important to understand. If you say that there's still a disproportion, okay, so Blacks make up 13% of the population, but maybe 25% maybe of those shot by the police, you could still argue at a more sophisticated level that's due to racism, but you then have to adjust for crime rate. So large groups that differ in terms of critically important characteristics like sex, ethnic background, race, also differ in terms of a lot of other variables. So the African-American modal or median age is a lot younger than the equivalent for whites. Modal average age for Blacks is, I think, 27. For whites, it's 58. Black people are a more working class community. We're a more urban community. And because of all that, we have a crime rate that's about 2.5 times the violent crime rate for whites. You can check this out in any year's annual BJS, Bureau of Justice Statistics report. So when you adjust for that, when you adjust just for crime and how often people encounter the police, because such a huge majority of crime is committed by young men, maybe 3% of the country, young Black men, another 6% of the country, young, poor, white, and Hispanic men, those guys are responsible for almost all the murders in the country. When you adjust for all of this, these gaps almost totally disappear. You might find some residual 5 or 6% effective racism. I mean, Roland Fryer's talked about that in the past. We don't want to totally ignore that. But the idea that there's this epidemic of police violence, or that police and young Black men are constantly clashing, or certainly that the races are close to any kind of ethnic conflict, ethnic war, I mean, that's just nonsensical. So yeah, I took this 30-page chapter and I just laid out all these dry but critically important stats in sort of bam, bam, bam fashion, where I'm saying, you know, no, this is the reality. These are the police shooting numbers. These are the police interaction numbers. These are the crime by race numbers. This may be awkward, but it's important to understand this if we're going to talk about this topic.
Well, let me just raise the elephant in the room here. Let's talk about Black Lives Matter for a minute. And when, let's see, back in 2020, we're dealing with COVID lockdowns. Then we had George Floyd, but there was some peaceful protest indeed. There was some rioting. And there was a lot of pressure on corporate America to make various statements about what was happening in American society, and generally also in support of Black Lives Matter. Now, I don't think anybody really denies that Black Lives Matter, almost nobody. But I think the organization seems to be going beyond that somewhat, let's say, harmless name to be making some rather controversial claims about the nature of American society. So I think it's perfectly possible for people to think that there are cases in which the police could have stood to defuse certain situations. There are certainly episodes where the police go overboard or they're using crazy ultra-militaristic type approaches. But I think what Black Lives Matter is saying is something much farther beyond that. And if you agree with me, what exactly are they saying about American society? They're not just saying, I don't think, that we have a police problem and some reforms might fix it.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to understand this whole trend of politicized language. So, I mean, if I go on a date with a feminist woman and she tells me that she is absolutely pro-choice in every situation, we might not be going on a second date, because she's not just saying that she believes humans have free will, right? Like, we're all pro-choice. I mean, that's a term used by, who is it, Descartes, cogito ergo sum? What that means in the United States, though, is I am for abortion, and I'm for abortion beyond the way in which most people are, which is through the first trimester if there's some kind of health issue. You're making a political statement. You're pro-choices versus pro-life. And similarly, everyone is pro-life, generically. You want every baby born to live. But not everyone agrees with that hard body position on abortion. Not everyone agrees with banning Plan B or something. So I dislike having my intelligence insulted when people engage in these kind of conversations. Like, yes, of course, Black lives matter. And you know what? All lives matter, too. You could go out on a fence and say, white lives matter. But when people use these slogans, like when a guy who's on the actual alt-right says white lives matter, or when a guy who's setting a store on fire is chanting Black Lives Matter, they're not making some anodyne statement about the value of human nature in the mind of Jesus or Socrates. I mean, we're wasting time here. Black Lives Matter, not you. Black Lives Matter, the political movement, is, I mean, an activist. I won't do the conservative cliche and say communist, but certainly Marxist-inspired movement that has a lot of very specific goals for Western society. I mean, if you do any background checking into Patrice Cullors or into allies like Sayura Rao, or if you just go to the main website for Black Lives Matter, by which I'm referring to the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, I don't know if they still have destroy the nuclear family up as a goal, but you'll see a free Palestine is still there, however. You'll see a lot of very hard-body left-wing political causes. And the argument that if you don't support these left-wing political positions, which are the exact across-the-aisle counterpoint of, say, a right-wing position Marjorie Taylor Greene might hold, you are a racist is simply nonsensical. So yeah, Black Lives Matter, in the political sense, is an activist group that probably the majority of Americans would disagree with. So I was once asked, kind of last statement, because I tend to be a long talker, as I say in speeches, but I was once asked, what do I think woke is? This is by Nina Turner or someone like a smart debater on the left side. And I think the expectation was that conservatives were going to stumble around and accidentally say mildly racist things and so on. And what I said is that there's actually a very easy three-part definition of this. Wokeness is, if you read books like Critical Race Theory, this very understandable three-part structure. I mean, part one is the idea that society is intentionally structured to discriminate against specific groups, like still today, post-affirmative action in 2023. And depending on the theory, the group might vary. I mean, a communist might say it's poor people or poor whites, poor people more specifically. A critical race theorist might say blacks. A fourth wave feminist might say women. A quote-unquote queer theorist might say anyone who's not typically heterosexual. And this varies often to the fringes with fat studies and so on. But point one of radical wokeness is that society is structured to oppress certain groups of people. And this isn't an accident. This isn't just coincidentally laws protecting property rights benefit those who have property. It's the actual goal of society, particularly in the West. Point two is that evidence of this oppression can be found anytime there's a gap in performance between two large groups. This is Ibram Kendi's whole baseline argument, that the only two possible explanations for any racial difference are what he literally openly calls inferiority. I swear he means genetic, one. Or two, racism somewhere, no matter how subtle it is, no matter how hard it is to find. So structured to oppress, all gaps indicate prejudice. And three, the solution to this is equity, which really just means proportional representation regardless of performance. And that's what Black Lives Matter is advocating. The argument that the police are racist, I mean, the majority of big city police departments that are 30%+ Black and Hispanic, or the proportion of departments that are 30%+ Black and Hispanic in cities has to be over 50, probably over 70. It doesn't matter. The simple fact that they arrest more Blacks than you would expect makes them racist. So these are BLM's core ideas. And you're absolutely right that the majority of Americans would find these to be nonsensical, probably reprehensible ideas. I do myself.
Well, let's develop this from there. The claim that only racism can account for X, Y, and Z comes up against just the general complexity of life. And this is something that over the course of decades of academic writing, Thomas Sowell, of course, was at great pains to emphasize when he would make international comparisons or comparisons among ethnic groups within the U.S. or immigrant groups. So he would say something like, for example, now this was back in the 80s. I'm sure the statistics are different now, but he said that Mexican-American women, fully half of them were married by ages 18 to 21, whereas only 10% of Japanese-American women were married by that age. Now, once you know that, then you realize that just simply comparing the outcomes or the net worth or whatever of Mexican-American women versus Japanese women is doomed to failure or irrelevance because it's apples and oranges. Because obviously, Japanese-American women are going to do different things, have different opportunities, just because of this one life decision.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the fact that the average age, although again, we're using a mode, but is 27 for blacks and 58 for whites. I mean, if you're comparing either crime rate on the right or wealth on the left, and you're not taking into account the fact that there's an age difference that can reach into decades, you're just being dishonest. One of the things that strikes me as extraordinarily bizarre about modern left-wing political theory, and this is theory at the highest level, these are books written by PhDs, is the idea that if it weren't for racial prejudice, everyone would be expected to perform similarly or identically. And just the mathematical laws of variance, I mean, how children perform in the same family indicate that that's not true. There's a 6 or 7% or whatever you learn in math 400, just natural variance among entities in a group. So, I mean, that's just not true even by the laws of science or creation or whatever term you want to use for that. But it's certainly not true given the actual patterns of difference between groups that we observe. There's no reason to assume that a 27-year-old guy in Mississippi with a degree from Southern Mississippi, a perfectly solid institution, is going to make as much money as a 58-year-old guy on Manhattan Island with a degree from Columbia or Yeshiva. It just doesn't make sense. What we do in serious, real social science is called multivariate analysis, to adjust for this, by the way. You break open a serious computer program like Stata, and you run an engineering-style model that looks at the effect of one variable on what you call the dependent variable with all the other variables held constant at the median or at a point you pick, the mean, whatever the case might be. So unless you're doing this, you're not really saying anything. Just saying black guys get arrested more than white guys, okay, the average black guy is 30 years younger than the average white guy. Even if you want to use a median age point analysis, 10 years younger than the average white guy and twice as urban. I don't want to dwell on this one point. That's not the most important as opposed to North versus South or test scores or something. But it's something that's so simple and so obvious and so non-controversial that it really helps illustrate how stupid the claim is. And I mean, in reality, we see gaps all around the world of this kind. As a political scientist specifically, I actually find the American debate about this to often be pretty provincial, is the word that comes to mind. So like there's a big IQ conversation in America where the kind of dissident right guys will critique blacks a lot and say, well, your average IQ is a bit lower. I mean, it's no longer the stereotypical 85. If you read Charles Murray's latest, it's risen to about 92, which indicates to me this is almost totally cultural, by the way. There hasn't been a massive genetic change in the black population in, what, 15 years since the bell curve. But anyway, whites, it's 100 or a bit under. Asians, it's 105. So there's this discussion, but the reality is that all of these scores are perfectly globally normal, tested IQs around the world, which again are mostly cultural in nature. I mean, they result from factors like, do you let women go to school? But I mean, they range from 59 to almost 110. So the claim that any gap you see here is due to this one thing, I don't just want to keep hitting this one nail with this one hammer, but it doesn't make sense. Why would Asians be in the lead? And that actually might be a good way to segue to your next question. Why would Asians be in the lead point? Mm-hmm. Many of the gaps that we see in the contemporary USA don't benefit whites. So if the argument is that the causal variable here has to be racism, how would you explain the fact that on the SAT exam, for example, the average score for Asian Americans is a bit over 1,200? I think it's 1,230 in the most recent year on record. I could be wrong. The average score for Hispanics, most of whom are of Caucasian descent, most of whom are counted as white by the census, is a 970. Why would these dark-skinned Caucasians who experience some prejudice in the USA underperform these absolutely non-white Easterners who experience some prejudice in the USA by 260 points? It doesn't make sense. The reality is that, of course, that there is an entire range of cultural, historical, systemic, regional, if you look at the North and the South, genetic, if you look at very least at men and women, so on down the line, variables that predict how people do. And the more we make it, cough, cough, taboo to talk about these issues, the more worthless a lot of sort of scientific analysis is going to be.
Absolutely. And not to mention, I think, if I'm remembering the bell curve correctly, I never actually read it. I just knew about it. I think like most people knew what the thesis was, but then that was it. But I remember Charles Murray trying to say if we don't just all sit down and have conversations like this and we just suppress it and force it underground, you're not going to like the form it's going to eventually take. It's much better for people to just talk about what they want to talk about, get everything on the table and see what's what. I am interested in your point about the rise in average IQ, because at least my understanding was that that shouldn't really be possible if IQ is what they're telling us it is.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, and there are guys that are at least as educated on this topic, Russell Warren comes to mind, that would probably disagree. But this to me is another one of these claims that borders on the ridiculous. Now, there actually is a technical second dimension here. The serious argument from a quote-unquote hereditarian would be that, and I think this is where Warren would fall, where Arthur Jensen might have fallen. I'm not trying to slander anyone holding a different position from mine. But the serious claim would be that there is something called G separate from IQ, which represents human maximal potential intelligence. And it really is very difficult to raise that, unless you're talking about diet from birth or something. But like that internet claim that you can't boost intelligence, you can't change, quote unquote, how smart people are. Yeah, that's facially nonsensical. I mean, I don't think that Asians are 100+ SAT points smarter, if you will, than Northern Europeans or Western coastal Africans or something like that. I don't. I think they study more. Like, the more time you spend training in the things that are actually on IQ tests, like plain geometry comes to mind, or like complex grammar, the better you're going to do on the test. So when you see these IQ scores from the developing world, like 79 from Albania, which is a Caucasian country, by the way, I actually don't think that means anything about the potential intelligence of Albanians. If you're taking a society that's making some big moves, but that's still in many areas largely rural, pretty strong attitudes against the education of women, at least in traditional Albania, traditional Kosovo. If you take someone that's never taken a test before and sit them down in front of the SAT, they're going to get a bad score. If you train every day for your entire life, you're going to get a better score. So the bell curve point was simply that, well, actually, first I'll finish my point, then I'll come to another point. So the point, read the bell curve, was simply that when the bell curve is written, the most news headline generating point in the book, obviously, wasn't the stuff about poor whites, which is actually very important. It wasn't the stuff about educational sorting, which is the most important thing in the book. Educational and political sorting is one of the biggest trends in our society. It was the claim that the tested Black IQ at the time was 85. And I've actually, Charles Murray's a good scholar. I've reviewed his numbers. The tested Black IQ at the time was 85. The problem for many of the hereditarians who follow Murray is that he wrote another book last year called Facing Reality, and the tested Black IQ was 91 or 92. I mean, he normed it from NAEP tests. The actual full-scale IQ tests in that same time frame produced the same result. So if you're arguing that there's this genetic, unflexible thing called IQ, and it's almost the same thing as G, and we may as well not spend a lot of money on those poor kids because nothing's going to change, your argument's just been proven wrong. I mean, we've seen a 7-point jump in IQ in 15 years. So, I mean, that happens all the time, obviously. I mean, I don't think anyone today would think that the Nigerian IQ or the Indian IQ, as we look at those rising powers, would still be 80 or whatever it was when they famously tested with Lin and von Hanen, was it? I mean, like, obviously, as Nigeria moves from being the 30th economy in the world, which is what it is now, to the 18th, they're not going to catch the bigger European countries. But you're going to see growth in those performance metrics as everyone in the country goes to school, even at a genetic level, if you want to go there, as rich men have more children, so on down the line. So these things change all the time. And at the non-genetic, purely cultural level, simply training and having enough to eat and understanding how to take tests that 40% of the answers are C and so on down the line, all of that is going to boost your score. This seems like just plain common sense. That's my point there. I'm a culturalist on IQ. Even if there are some 3% genetic group differences, and I'm far from convinced there are, the difference in what you're going to get if you really study 3 hours a day from sixth grade through 12th grade and what you're going to get if you don't far outweighs that, if that makes sense. And I think every soul on charter schools in 2020, every serious study that's really looked at that goes out of its way to make that point. The last thing I will say about Big Chop, Charles Murray, is that he's absolutely right. Like, the fact that you can't discuss the hereditarian position, which is one of the three major positions on this in psychology, by the way. Like, there's nothing taboo about this. I mean, Arthur Jensen is not a racist in any traditional sense of that word, has forced a lot of this conversation into these weird areas of the internet. So if you search IQ blog, you'll find debating threads on the American Renaissance alt-right site and so on. Yeah, I think it's much better to have these conversations out in the open. What percentage of people do think Asians or Jews are a few points smarter? 70? Black guys are slightly better athletes? 60? I mean, there's no real reason you can't talk about that in public, just as you can say men are more aggressive than women. This is why the book was titled as it was. We seem to keep building these walls of taboo that prevent very normal conversations, like, could my buddy be a few points smarter than me? And so that's forced them underground. And it's created these large alt-right, hotep, as we say in the African-American world, et cetera, spaces. And I do think that's profoundly unhealthy. The manosphere is now another one of these.
Well, let me take one more thing before I let you go.
Okay.
That obviously, again, we could do a whole episode on it. But just to get your general thoughts on it, out of chapter 7, where you say, we're going to take a minute to talk about the idea of white privilege. Now, I can understand somebody who says to me that if I'm white and I walk down the street, I don't have to endure, let's say, old ladies clutching their purses close to them because they think I might rob them. Or maybe I get treated a little bit nicer, even subconsciously, by a store owner or something like that. Like, maybe there are things that I don't even notice on a daily basis that other people don't have that same luxury. So do you think there is anything to it at all? Because you could either say there's nothing to the idea at all, or that it is the single most important interpretive lens for understanding American life, or maybe there's a third option.
Well, I think there's clearly a third option, which is that being a member of the majority race in a powerful country can sometimes grant advantages, but is by no means as important as being smart or beautiful or wealthy or 100 other things. I will say also, I think it's become a bit of a cliche. People say, believe all women, believe people of color. It's become a bit of a cliche to believe ridiculous things that people say when they're claiming oppression. I mean, this might have been different when I was a hood kid with my skateboard and all that, white tee. But I'll tell you, as a black businessman, when you walk down the street, you don't see people clutching their purses and screaming. I mean, in Chicago, a lot of this stuff, I almost don't believe happened. When people say that they're receiving 15 death threats a day on the internet for articulating conventional liberal positions, or they can't engage in any business meeting without being sexually harassed, that's very different from any experience that not only I have ever had, but that I have ever seen anyone have. And it's the same thing with this. Unless you actually look like a gangster, and there are plenty of, I mean, in Chicago, you'd probably think Italian, Puerto Rican, perhaps some Irishmen until recently. I mean, there are plenty of people of all backgrounds that have that look. But unless you have it, people aren't really running away from you when you go down the street to go to Nordstrom Rack. I mean, that's not something I encounter. But I mean, certainly there are some fairly convincing studies that find that names, for example, that are very ethnic tend to be discriminated against in favor of names of the Trace Bunkington III variety, that sort of thing. So yeah, white privilege can exist. The simplest way to say this is there's a 110-question study which famously led the BuzzFeed website. And it was designed by, I believe, Ivy League grad students, some up-and-coming young quants, at least as far as I understand. It's certainly quite well designed. But there are about 100 questions on the survey, and they range from, have you ever gone to bed hungry, to have you ever lost a physical fight, to have you ever had an unpaid internship, which is actually a sign of privilege that you could take that on. And I've administered this survey in classrooms, so on, to see what the results are. And the goal is there's a 100-point score at the end that measures your overall privilege ranking. It's a reasonable metric. We could tighten it up a bit and get a good social science article out of it. And the thing that seems to produce about 70% of privilege is just pure social class. The social class metric that I used on these surveys was just really, really simple. It was, how much money do you make? And if you're under 26, how much money do your parents make? It was nothing very complicated. But wealth is by far the biggest predictor of how you're going to be treated in day-to-day kind of business life. If you walk into a car dealership, if you walk into a restaurant, so on down the line, where you're seated and that sort of thing, how your approach is going to depend far more on your appearance, presentation, visible SES, open presence of a credit card, so on down the line, than on your racial background. And there were a number of other things that also played a role. I mean, sexism still seems to be more prevalent than racism. Gay men, although not, I will note, sort of bisexual or even gay women, face discrimination. Farm kids had it pretty bad. I mean, rural kids reported levels of deprivation in terms of some of the services that were discussed, levels of physical violence, levels of job market and discrimination. They were actually on par with urban, quote unquote, hood kids. I mean, it's a tough life waking at 4 a.m. on a farm to feed the animals and so on. And that's still a good chunk of the country. 10% or more of people live in rural or ex-urban counties. So there are all of these things that actually determine how easy your life is going to be. One of the biggest predictors of business success for men, and this might sound almost like a joke, but it's not. The data on this is much more robust than the data on race, is height. So there are almost no Fortune 500 CEOs under 5'10", for example. I'm right at the cutoff mark, actually. Like, I could get rich, might not. So white privilege is one of many, many potential privileges that exist in a complex world. And focusing only on this one thing, which probably ranks number 12th out of the full set of things that determine how you're going to be treated, is a weird quirk of the time that we're living in. It's not that this can never be an advantage, being, you know, a blonde member of the majority in an interview. It's not that this is going to determine your entire life. It's just one of many factors, maybe. And the final line, no one ever says this either, but there's clearly also black privilege, or whatever you want to call it, POC privilege, simply in the sense that there exists institutional affirmative action. So, I mean, in very many situations in the kind of modern upper middle class world that you and I both probably live in by this point in our lives, if I'm applying to, or my son by this point is applying to prep school, college, grad school, law school, medical school, any Fortune 500 job, he is going to have, I mean, assuming I have a black partner, black wife, he is going to have a substantial advantage over an equally qualified white peer. So you can not only discuss white privilege, you can discuss black privilege or reversed racism, specifically because life is complex, it's multivariate, and you need to adjust for all of the things that might be involved when you're conducting an analysis before you determine why the result looks as it does.
I can't help thinking, as I listen to you talk, that when I look back at your title of your book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, the word you is kind of standing out to me here, because you are in a unique situation here, because you are at a historically black university, and you're black yourself, and we all know how American life works. You're supposed to have certain opinions that we can predict. Everybody's supposed to fit into a nice little box. Everybody's supposed to be a category rather than a person, and you don't want to do that. And I'm just curious what I can sort of guess, but what has this been like for you? I'm sure you've been accused of just being a lackey of the white establishment or whatever. And no doubt there are people who maybe do wish you ill, who nevertheless benefit from some of the things you're teaching. How do you navigate all that?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of this sort of internet drama isn't really to be taken all that seriously in real life, especially as an adult man. I mean, actually, I've had very little public backlash at Kentucky State that I've experienced. Maybe I'm insensitive to a throttled glance or something like that. But I seem to be rated as a pretty popular professor, that kind of thing. I will say that I think the extreme wokeness that people think about when they think about academia is in fact concentrated in a few specific places, like along the two coasts and so on. If you go to any of the great A&Ms, Texas and so on, that were set up as kind of the third school in their states, focusing on the STEM arts, if you go to any of the military academies, that goes beyond West Point to the Citadel and so on, any of the community colleges that actually make up about half of American higher education, many of which have better performing faculty members in my experience than the back end of the four-year college market, so on down the line, you're not really finding a bunch of people with purple hair marching around campus with signs saying things like free the livestock. You're encountering people who want to be nurses and school teachers and so on down the line. So, I mean, at KSU, in fact, you mentioned WKU, so on. I don't think that I'd encounter a whole lot of hysterical backlash. And I haven't so far for being kind of center right. I mean, that would be my main take. The comments, and because I am on the internet, you do get some of these comments like, you're standing up for the white devil and sort of this sort of thing. I view it kind of as a joke. But I mean, in terms of the idea that to be an intelligent black guy or woman or something like this, and to disagree with utterly mainstream kind of upper class democratic talking points is to be controlled by someone, that's a genuinely bizarre position. I mean, so if I'm mouthing GOP talking points, the obvious reply would be that anyone disagreeing with me is mouthing DNC talking points. Most ideas have been articulated by someone before. And I'd actually like to expand this a little bit, because one of the worst arguments that's made pretty frequently is the sort of Hitler drank water argument, where if you make a coherent hereditarian or culturalist claim, for example, one of the problems with reparations is the fact that African Americans are obviously objectively not worse off now than we would be had our ancestors remained in Africa, where they were already slaves, like they were slaves to, say, the Ashanti. If you say that, an automatic response is, well, that's what racists used to say. You don't want to sign on to that, do you? It's probably true that many hered or culturalist or whatever arguments were made in the past by bigots. But it's also true that most blank slate environmentalist arguments were made in the past by Joseph Stalin, for example. I mean, who was a big fan of actual Lysenkoism. Nothing could be genetic, anything could be changed. That doesn't mean that the claim that improving funding for the schools in a specific circumstance might not improve performance. It doesn't say anything about the validity of environmentalist arguments that Stalin made them. So how do I personally feel about the fact that some people dislike my political takes? I don't really care. I think it's funny. But more broadly, for people who are affected by this kind of thing, who think something obvious like, man, I'm glad I'm an American instead of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, it's important to realize that it's not a rebuttal of your position for someone to say that a racist once held it. The easy comeback is, well, a communist once held your position. But neither argument means anything. The question is, which position is more correct, more empirically supported by the facts?
If people want to follow you, is there a way? I mean, of course, I want people to read your book, which I'm going to link to at tomwoods.com/2285, your book Taboo. And I'm just in the process. Let's see if I can find it right here. I just followed you on Twitter, so I'll also link to your Twitter on that same page. But do you have a place, like a regular outlet where you write?
Well, yeah. I mean, so first of all, to follow me online, you would literally just Google Wilfred Reilly. It's WILFREDREILLY. Or use any other search engine. I tend to recommend Bing, DuckDuckGo, even Yandex with safe settings on over Google. Google manipulates the results to a remarkable degree. But search me and you'll find my Twitter university website with my direct link. You'll find my Facebook and other socials, my articles. I have a couple of pretty regular writing portals. I'm a regular columnist for National Review on the right side of things. I also write and edit for some pretty apolitical social science journals. I'm one of the founders of JOIBS, Journal of Open Inquiry in the Behavioral Sciences, with Lee Jussum and Corey Clark. I think I'm still on the board of the Journal of Hate Studies. I mean, I write pretty regularly for Commentary, Quillet, so on down the line. So I'm not hard to find at all as a writer. So I'm pretty easy to figure out online. I would literally encourage just Googling me and adding me on Twitter or whatever.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I did. And I got, as you say, I got quite a few results. So as I say, I'll link to the Twitter. I'll link to your book. Obviously, the book we've been talking about is Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. Have all this linked at tomwoods.com/2285. Well, I appreciate your time, Will. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. Love talking to you. Have a great day.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, folks, that is another episode of The Tom Woods Show. I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.